I'm talking today with Mr. John Lyne Traub at his home on Baker Avenue in Abington. Today is May 19th, 1980.
Okay. Well, first of all, I see that you were born in New York City, and I wonder how you came to Harford County.
Well, I originally came to Harford County as a tourist back in, about 1924. And my mother and father and brother and I drove down. I remember we crossed the double-decker bridge in Havre de Grace. I think the reason we came was because my father was an engineer and architect, and he wanted to see that double-decker bridge. Mm-hmm. And so we came down, of course, the old Route 7, which was the only highway into Harford County at that time. And I have no memory at all of what we did when we got here. We crossed that double-decker bridge coming in and back. And whether we just turned around and went back, I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But I think that was my first trip into Harford County. That was many years ago, of course. Mm-hmm. And then when I graduated from New York University, I took a commission in the Chemical Corps, or Chemical Warfare Service, as it was called then. And my first summer camp was at Fort Hoyle for Edgewood Arsenal. And so I got to know a little more about Harford County. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when World War II broke out, I was called to service at Edgewood Arsenal and spent 4 years there. I think it was 4 years there. I came down just a month before Pearl Harbor. I was on active duty then throughout the war at Edgewood Arsenal. I never left. I was in the pyrotechnics end of it, smoke munitions development, pilot plant operation. And at the end of the war, then I went back to New Jersey to work for a company I'd been with before service. And then came back in 48 as a civilian at Edgewood Arsenal and lived up in initially in Port Deposit for that first winter, and then moved down to what is the name of that farm over there? Well, first we moved down to Edgewood, and then we moved out to
Myers
Farm. Boston.
Oh,
yeah.
Gimple's,
Colonel Gimple. When he became a colonel, but he was retired when we moved out there. Mm-hmm. And then moved back onto the arsenal. Well, that was during the war. I said that was following the war, but no, that was during the war.
Mm-hmm.
And following the war, we went back to New Jersey, and then back 2 years later in 48, moved directly into this house. So we've lived in this house some 33 years now. And Mrs. Longley owned all of the land up in here. They had the old Longley farm. The original farm, I think, covered most of what is now Longmore Harbor. But they developed it standpoint of real estate. Mm-hmm. This particular house was owned by a Judge Robinson. I know nothing about him. He had sold it to a man by the name of Elder, and I bought it from the heirs of the Elder estate.
Mm-hmm.
had a funny clause in the anyhow, this was a dirt road that you came in on, and mud every spring, mud up the hubcaps. See, I was not in Harford County when they built Route 40. That was back in the early 30s, wasn't it? I'm not sure.
Do you remember what Fort Hoyle was like? Was that a separate part of Edgewood Arsenal?
Yeah, or? It was. See, that's where they stationed the, what they call the Mountain Mortar Brigade or something similar to that. Mule-drawn mortars. The old 4-inch Stokes mortar to begin with, and then the 4.2. 4-inch was just a smooth barrel mortar like this, like any of the infantry mortars. And they could carry it by hand in pieces, but it was mostly mule-drawn. There were stables there at Fort Hoyle. We went riding in off hours on the horses there.
Was it, how developed was the arsenal in Fort Hoyle then? I mean, were they just starting to put up barracks and things?
Well, see, many of the wooden buildings were put up during 1917, 18, 19, when they started making mustard gas at Edgewood Arsenal for use in World War I. And many of those buildings were still there, practically all of them were still there in 1941. And it wasn't until the last 20 or 30 years that they tore them down and replaced them with better structures. But when I reported there in 41, active duty, the old mustard gas plant was still there and the old white phosphorus loading plant. We inherited many of those buildings and put in pilot plants and smoke loading, munitions loading plants. The original incendiary bombs that Jimmy Doolittle dropped on Tokyo were made here at Edgewood. Mm-hmm. And this happened that at that time I was in charge, captain, in charge of the pilot plant that built those bombs.
Mm-hmm.
Recollection. Well, no, I also ran the smoke plant that filled the floating smoke pots that were used in the invasion in Africa. They were all made in a pilot plant before we went into industrial production.
Hmm.
It was very interesting. Everybody worked. Didn't matter much difference what you wore on your shoulder. You operated a press if it was necessary.
Were there a lot of people employed there at that time?
Yes. I can't give you the numbers because I don't know them.
Mm-hmm.
But 41 through 45, it was a very active post. I guess. Well over 10,000 people there at that time.
Hmm.
Say, I don't know anything about the personnel records or the numbers of people.
Mm-hmm. Did you get out to the rest of Harford County, you know, say on, I guess, where were you, lived at Port Deposit the first time?
I lived at Port Deposit when we first reported for active duty.
Mm-hmm.
And then moved down to Edgewood Road. Remember, we got fresh milk there. We to our two children, and then myself too, walk up to Myers Farm, which is back up on the right-hand side of the road as you go in, with a couple of gallon buckets of milk, and we'd get fresh milk right from the barn there.
Hmm.
This was in 1941.
Now, coming from a more built-up, were you coming from a pretty well built-up area into a...
Well, yes. Yes and no. We were in suburban New Jersey, mm-hmm. but still, suburban New Jersey was like Bel Air is now.
Mm-hmm.
There were individual houses, and each one had their own garden and yard,
mm-hmm.
but no acreage.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the school systems were quite different. New Jersey, along with New York, had the highest, degree of highest level of education per grade, so that when we moved down here, our children went into the same grade they'd been in New Jersey. But they knew everything that was being taught. They'd already learned all that.
Mm.
So for the first year, it was very bad for them. They just didn't have to work. They could play every afternoon. They'd already been through all that they were learning here in the same grade they'd been in.
Mm.
Of course, things have changed considerably since then. The Maryland school system has improved immensely. The level of learning per grade has gone up, so that I think it now rates along with the best of them, but I have nothing other than my belief of that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. I work with the school system now. I show slides of our travels around this country and around other countries to the fifth grade students over here at the William Packer School.
Mm.
Yeah. Seven classes all in the fifth grade all come together on one afternoon a week, and
mm-hmm.
I show them slides of all of the states and
mm.
places in the United States and
mm-hmm.
places we've been overseas.
Mm.
So they enjoy that, and so I have a little contact with the school.
Mm-hmm.
But to go back, when I was working in New Jersey before the war, I took several trips. I was in a stainless steel manufacturing company that produced items for chemical plant production, and I was a sales engineer for them, and I made numerous trips to Baltimore and the vicinity around,
mm-hmm.
and of course drove through Harford County on the way down.
Were people receptive to you, the natives that were here, or was there a large influx of new people at that around the 40s?
Oh yes, there was quite a large influx of new people. And I would say that the people were very friendly, but we'd only been here 2 or 3 years, you were a newcomer, you know, and you knew you were a newcomer. But it was a friendly atmosphere, really.
Mm-hmm.
Considering the way you can go in cold in some other places and you stay cold for 20 or 30 years, it wasn't so here.
Mm-hmm. What was the village of Edgewood like? Do you remember anything about how that was?
K.B. Smick's store down there. In fact, he lived next door to us out here. His home was out here,
mm-hmm.
and he operated the store, it was a general store, actually,
mm-hmm.
just down across the street from the post office down there.
Mm-hmm.
And the Edgewood was hardly developed after all. Myers operated their farm just a mile outside, or even half a mile outside of the old town.
Yeah.
And Willoughby Beach and all that area was pure wild. We, one of our first experiences was taking a swim up over here off. There was not a soul there. We took a canoe down, Winter's Run, and came out into the bay here, and the river, I guess you'd call it, and a nice sandy beach over there and clear water, and we were in our bathing suits, so we jumped in and had a swim. We could see the highway across, the Route 40 across, but it was so isolated there were no homes around.
We'd come down from Edgewood Road.
Yeah, we'd come down from
Carried
Edgewood.
Carried the canoe down to Winter's Run from Edgewood Road.
Let's see. The swans used to be thick over in there, in Gunpowder, in Gunpowder Bay. They're not now, but there used to be thousands of them. And geese too. Lots of geese around. It's not so anymore. Swans used to come right in off the point here and dive. And there were several years when we had thousands of ducks out here. But the geese now they come in and stay out in the middle of the river, two-thirds of the way over to the bridge, and form a big flock out there, swim around. They come in October, early November, and this last winter they stayed all winter. They sat on the ice out there, and they'd fly into the farmers' fields over here for the grain they could pick up and come back at night. So they never left this year. Well, some of them did, of course, but I mean, there were geese out there every night. You could just sit there and hear them honk, 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 talk among themselves.
Was your experience at Edgewood Arsenal, was there a lot of different activities going on during the war over there? I mean, you had said it was a pretty busy place.
Well, yeah, it was. Let's see, it was the parent arsenal to the other three chemical arsenals, Huntsville Arsenal, Pine Bluff Arsenal, and Rocky Mountain Arsenal. And all of the design work for those three arsenals was based on what was learned here at Edgewood on proper handling of toxic chemicals and incendiaries, colored smoke munitions and all of that. And we went as teams or as individuals to those arsenals, flew there to advise when they would have problems and get them straightened out, and then we'd come back here. And I remember one experience at Huntsville Arsenal. They telephoned, I was here at the arsenal, and they telephoned and asked me how to mix a certain yellow smoke mix, and we had just gotten a new piece of equipment in that looked real good. So when I knew they had one of those, I said, well, you just mix it in that blender now, and you won't have any problems. Oh, good. This mixer, that blender down there, let me know how it works out. They called me back about 20 minutes later and said it just went up in flames. So I promptly called Huntsville Arsenal and I said, hey, I gave you some bum advice. We just burned our mixer up. A yellow smoke mix was approximation of black gunpowder. I mean, it friction would set it off. It was the most flammable, easily set off of all of our colored smoke mixes. And so we had to be very careful how that was mixed.
Now, what would colored smoke be used for?
It was used for signaling.
That was pretty forward technology for that time, I guess, wasn't it?
Oh yeah it was. It was. While the colored smokes were all developed over here in the pyrotechnic division, that was worked out the formulas and would specify the dyes, and then my division would take their rough approximations and put them into the pilot plan and produce maybe 1,000, 2,000, or 10,000 munitions to see how it would go in production. Mm. And when we'd worked out the production bugs, then we would give our information to the producing arsenal. Huntsville Arsenal was the major colored smoke arsenal. Then Pine Bluff took it up after Huntsville was closed. But we made colored smoke here at Ridgewood for a long time. Of course, all of the white phosphorus handling techniques were developed here at Ridgewood Arsenal. White phosphorus was a very tricky material to handle. It would burst into flame in contact with air. Just a small leak would start a fire. And then the incendiaries were long tubular. To begin with, they were long tubular steel-nosed things that you packed with a thermite mix and make liquid molten iron when they went off. Mm. These were what were dropped on Germany and on Tokyo. We made them hundreds of thousands here at Edgewood.
Now, was there a lot of enthusiasm about what you were doing, and a lot of that kind of feeling that you were helping the effort?
Yeah, the morale was very high. Well, we'd have problems once in a while, but I know the commanding general bawled me out once because I had too much litter around when we were making the bombs that we were going to put on Tokyo. All I could do was shake my head and say, well, I can spend my time making bombs, or I can spend half my force in cleaning up. To me, I thought it was more important to make bombs. Well, so you get that order, finish, clean up. We did.
Did you have trouble sometimes, or were there explosions and things?
Yes, we had fires. We had some bad white phosphorus fires. They were in the production division at the time. Les Conklin, I think, was boss of the production division. And managed to kill a few people over there. Mm. They had one bad fire that spread rapidly into some loaded munitions, and they took off, and they lost the building. Mm.
Why were all all these kind of activities going on at Edgewood. Was there any reason why at Edgewood other than...
Well, Edgewood had the mission of development of all ground, aerial munitions that carried white phosphorus or smokes or incendiaries and toxic agents, and also the harassing agents, tear gas, vomit gas, and all those. So it was the center of research and development for chemical warfare.
Were we ahead of most of the other countries in chemical warfare?
No. Well, England and Germany were ahead of us. We learned much that we put into practice here from England. England was the best on research, and we picked up their information and put it into production.
Mm-hmm.
I know when it came to nerve gas, took a trip over to England to see how they were doing, and they had a pilot plant that would produce 10 pounds of nerve gas a day. And we were building a pilot plant that would produce a ton of nerve gas a day. And it was a very expensive plant to build. And my English counterpart said to me over there, he said, "What do you know that we don't? That you can build a pilot plant and make a ton a day, and we can only make 10 pounds. I said, "Well, that's real simple." I said, "You've got more taxpayers." He looked at me and he says, "Well, maybe you got a point." But our pilot plant was very successful. And we went on to design and build a big production plant in Denver. Manager of our pilot plant, who worked for me at that time, went to Denver as the plant manager of the production plant and stayed out there until the end of the war.
Mm-hmm.
So we not only gave them information, but we trained people. Our trained people moved out.
Mm-hmm.
And then they offered me the job out there as chief engineer of the arsenal. More fun back where I am. They could pay more, but I was had more things back here to work on, and I wasn't really interested in moving to Denver at the time.
Mm.
Denver's a beautiful place to be, but I knew at the end of the war things would all close down, and there I'd be out in the west, and all my friends and relations were here in the east.
Mm.
I wasn't seriously tempted.
Mm-hmm.
We like Harford County very much.
Mm-hmm.
We have had, as I say, we've been all over the United States and Canada, all of the provinces of Canada and many of the territories. Now all these places are wonderful to visit, but when we come back here and sit here, we say, "Gee, what'd we leave for?" You know, well, you've got to go see some of the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you get involved in scouting?
Yeah, that was later. Oh, let's see. Somewhere in the 60s, I believe, I became assistant scoutmaster of a troop in Addington. And then the scoutmaster, who was an army captain, he had to leave, and I took over the troop then, and I guess I had the troop for 10 years. until I was 62, I think. I was the oldest scoutmaster in the Baltimore metropolitan area, including, of course, Harford County. So I figured I was about time I let somebody younger take it. Unfortunately, there were three backup men who could take it over, and when I went. Rallies, winter camps. One winter camp we got out there, we got down to 5 below 0. That was a cold one. In fact, we had to leave before the second night because there was a big blizzard coming up from Virginia. And I guess I persuaded the county executive that it was just good common sense if we left. So he finally agreed with me. Everybody left but one troop. They couldn't see any reason to leave. Well, they got the army snow ducks or whatever they're called, their snow vehicles, went in and rescued them 2 days later.
Oh,
my gosh. It would have been pretty bad. I figured, sure, we could survive it, but we also had a duty to the parents of the boys. They would just all be have fits if we just elected to stay overnight.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, all the parents were glad we brought the boys home. I got my Eagle Scout when I was back up in Yonkers, New York, where I was spending my youth. But and my youngest son got his Eagle Scout here in Abingdon. Henry Sonberg's boys got their Eagles too. It was a very active troop. We rated high in the competitions in the council. Actually did a lot of camping scouting. Scouting was mostly all about getting the boys to be self-reliant and self-sufficient and putting them in positions where they had to make decisions and live by the results.
What about the, were you also president of the Lumbar Improvement Association?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd only been there 2 years, I think, maybe 3 years, and I went over to a meeting of the Lumbar Improvement Association, and I got sucked in right away. I was made a vice president, and a year later I was president, and well, it was largely place where people would get together and really argue about what they would like to see happen here. We did get the street lights put in, the electric street lights, and we fought the Corps of Engineers closing the bridge over here, and between us and other groups we succeeded in keeping the bridge open so boats would be free to go in and out. And then, I guess 10 years later, I was president again. And at that time, there was not much going on, and instead of having a meeting once a month, we changed it to once every 4 months. Membership, the numbers of people who would attend meetings was in the order of half a dozen to a dozen. It was, just wasn't worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as we maintain the organization so it would be viable and there in case some problem came up, which it did, I think the Corps of Engineers tried again to get that bridge welded shut.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just circulated a petition, took it around, and got all the signatures, all members of the association.
Mm-hmm.
So it was there and available. Since then, it's been reorganized, the name has been changed, and I really don't know too much about it. They have they have a dance once a year, I think, or an oyster roast or crab feast or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's more entertainment.
Is this area of the county sort of neglected by Harford County? Do you feel like you're neglected?
Well, I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't say so. They keep the road in good shape. They paved it a couple of times when I didn't think it needed it. They were wasting their money just trying to prove that they were good people over there. They wanted our votes, I think. Yeah, the last time they paved it, I was reasonably sure that it was unnecessary. There's no reason to have a road in such condition that you can go 50 miles an hour. The speed limit is 30 miles an hour, and there are places where even that is too fast. There's no reason why you just can't. Plus, I'm getting old too, and I frown on some of this high-speed stuff kids like to indulge in.
Mm-hmm. Were you on the election board?
I still am.
Oh.
Still am. Now, I've been on the election board now for maybe 10 years. I'm a judge at the election.
Oh.
I missed November's election because we were in Japan for 3 weeks at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I had told them in the spring that we were going to Japan and did they want me to be available at the primary. And they said, yes, you can do your regular job at the primaries and we know that you won't be there in November, it won't be held against you. So I expect every 2 years they inquire, do you want to remain on the election board?
Mm-hmm.
Make your decision then. Of course, this was a dull year. Won't be any major elections or anything else this year. We might have a special election, but we don't know about that until it comes up, a special voting.
What about the Harford County Bush River Advisory Board? What's that about?
Oh, a couple, 3 years ago, the Federal Environmental Agency set up advisory panels on all freshwater areas. The Bush River was feed into the Chesapeake Bay, and they had advisory panels on the Middle River, had one on Swan Creek. Well, the one on Swan Creek was combined with this one. But to review the plans, we were particularly concerned at that time with the plans on the sewer sod run operation over there. And we held meetings with the state authorities, and they kept us advised of all of the actions they were going to take. And I remember we opposed one action, the dumping of the sewage from Sod Run, changing it from Sod Run, from Thomas Run, I guess it is, to Bush River. We were just going to dump it in about a mile and a half below the bridge out there.
Mm.
And so they had a hearing, a county hearing, and we went up, and I remember I made a pitch at that time. And they still, the EPA insisted that the $3 million or more that it would cost to run the line all the way out to Chesapeake Bay was not justified. And I think now they are planning, they either are taking action to put it in Bush River, or they already are doing it. And I remember just last year, the county water commission man on that called me and asked for a letter. They were going to change the process at the plant to eliminate one of the processes that reduces nitrates, nitrification plant. And of course there was a great deal of pressure on the federal funding authority to make this money go as far as it could. And so they had considered that this was a unproven necessity. So I think that's been eliminated now, too. Whether it's unproven or whether we get a back river situation here, we don't know. Mm-hmm. It depends, really, on the flow of the Bush River up at this end and Winter's Run over at this end, whether there's adequate flow and pressure to keep all this moving down, because we get tide comes in here. Mm-hmm. We get about normally about a foot to a foot and a half change in the water level where the water comes in. Mm-hmm. And in a period of drought, there is no flushing action in those rivers, and actually they drain a lot of farmland, and so the phosphorus content, nutrients that come into the river through these two sources are pretty high. So we do get some bloom here in the sun, a hot summer, if there's not too much rainfall. And they even prohibited swimming from over here at Willoughby Beach, the county did. Closed the beach and advised all residents of Bush River to forego swimming for a year or two. They still water skied out here, though. Paying attention to it. I don't know how clean the water of the river is now. Don't hear much about it.
Do you think that's going to be a problem in the future?
Oh, definitely. It's going to be a problem in either one or two, possibly three ways. Either they will not be permitted to expand the communities because of the incapability of the sewage system to carry more sewage, or they're going to ignore that end of it and overload the sewage plant and in turn pollute this water very severely to affect even the fishing in there. Which they're, according to federal regulation, they're prohibited from doing. And that's what this advisory council was set up for, was to assure that the recreational capability of the river was maintained. Mm-hmm. Of course, the county council over there are pressured by the federal government. They have to do sometimes things that they don't want to do. But we run into a real drought situation here. We're going to have a smelly river. And as they build more homes in the communities around it, increase the sewage flow from all over the county into Sod Run, it's just going to be more than they can handle. Of course, that was Aberdeen Proving Grounds' complaint about the little creek they were using from the initial Sod Run installation. It got so heavily polluted that all the fish disappeared from there, and it was just an open sewage ditch from Sod Run 7 miles out to the bay. And so the Aberdeen military authority said, we're just going to have to withdraw the authority you have now to dump Sod Run waste into that creek. You're going to have to find some other way of doing it. But you cannot use Aberdeen Proving Ground streams anymore, because you have definitely ruin this one, and it'll take a number of years for it to clear up again. So that was where one of the pressures came from, to find some other outlet. And there was a choice of either dumping it into the Bush River or building a main, 4 foot, 5 foot, I don't know, 6 foot main all the way out to a mile off of the point at the end of the Aberdeen Proving Ground.
Is that going to be a real problem in the future for Harford County as it seems to keep growing?
Harford County has their plan, I think, double the population in 10 years is what they're planning. Mm-hmm. And much of it will be up county, not some of it around here. I mean, they're still building around here. Mm-hmm. And all of the county sewage goes into Side 1 now from Belair. I don't think there's any. Well, Aberdeen, of course, has a sewage plant, and Havre de Grace has a sewage plant. Aberdeen's was, and Havre de Grace both were being hard pressed to keep up with the increased flows they were getting. Hmm. We both visited Sod Run here couple of years ago, just so we'd know what the darn thing looked like. They were very friendly over there. They took us around, showed us everything, and appeared to have everything under control. Mm. But there's always a temptation, if you've got a big backup and it's a dark, stormy night, open the valve and get rid of your problem. Hope it flushes out. Mm. There's always that temptation. And there was a chap at the county hearing who worked at Sod Run who said that had happened. He had been told and directed to do just that. So I'm reasonably sure it's not a common practice. But when you have the alternative of having everything flood all over the place down there or dump it in the river, I think the river wins out. It's a hard choice. Or maybe I should say the river loses out.
Has Long Bar changed very much since when you moved here?
Oh, yeah. All of practically all of the east end is new, and most of the homes around on the bend up here by Longleaf, let's see, this house was here, Longleaf was there, Cogswell's up at the head of the street was there, and there was one other. Well, across the field, that one on the corner across the field was there. And some of those along West Baker on the shore were there. But I would guess the number of houses since 1948 when we moved into this house has certainly more than doubled, and maybe tripled.
Do you remember the Longleys?
Oh, yes.
Were Alice Longley?
There were two. There was a grandmother who lived in the cottage right over across the way here. And her daughter-in-law, yeah. She was Alice, too, wasn't she? Weren't they both Alice? I'm not sure. And Mr. Longley, and then all of the children. And Tom Longley, one of the boys, lives in the house over here. And Alice Couch lives in the house just by right next to us over here. She was Alice Longley,
mm-hmm.
and Marge Longley, daughter, now Marge Human, Dr. Human's wife, lives in Bel Air, but they own this cottage at the head of the field here,
mm-hmm.
and their son is living in that. So the Longleys are still very well represented. Grandmother and her daughter-in-law and her husband, they've all died since we came here.
Mm-hmm.
And remember the children, black children and their children.
To have the little houses along the shore side, was this always sort of a area for
summer area. This was a summer home. When we bought it, it had no central heat. It had a little kerosene stove in the dining room.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't have running water. We had a pump, a well on a pump.
Mm-hmm.
And no city water, no, all right. And the septic tank in the field here. Of course, now we connected to city water and city sewage, and an oil burner, furnace, hot air heat. We've got a solar unit over here, hot water. And when it first came, a dock, well, you can see a post out there.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be a dock went out 200 feet, six feet wide. And before we came here, the year before we came here, there had been a square section on the end with a summer shelter on it. But that was taken out in the hurricane before we came down here. The dock was washed away by hurricane about three times at least. We had to rebuild it. And then the last thing that happened was we got a very hard winter, and the ice froze around the pilings, and the tide came in and it jacked the pilings up, and then at night the ice would go down again, leave the pilings up, and finally the pilings got jacked right straight up out of the ground and fell over, so there was nothing left to build a dock on.
Mm.
So since then we haven't had anything but a little dugout slip here. Launch a canoe. We had an outboard motor, but no, never had a power boat.
Mm-hmm.
So we canoe all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't started this year yet.
Has the shoreline around Bush River changed very much in your time?
As regards houses?
Well, I guess not.
The retreating of the shoreline?
Yeah.
No.
Was there once a boat works over toward Perryman area?
Well, yeah, there was a boat. Boat works Forest Green.
Mm.
Just up the shore from the crab house over there. Well, they still may, Forest Green.
It's a marina.
Well, it's a marina now, but the guy used to build boats.
Hmm.
But I don't know of any. Oh, wait a minute. There was a. Right on Route 40, as you cross a little bridge up here at Route 40, there was a wood barn like structure. Chap built boats right there.
Hmm.
Oh, what's the name of that? it's just up the road here, a couple hundred yards.
Hmm.
There was an old gray shed there that I was told was a boat works.
Hmm.
I never saw any boats built there.
Mm-hmm. Were most people had the what kind of boats on this river? Have they been basically small or, single engine boats? no sailboats or anything like that?
Well, there's sailboats and sailboat races out here. And just this side of the bridge, they race around in this area here, small sailboats.
Hmm.
No large sailboats because it's too difficult to get in and out. But there's the Bush River Boat Club. They call it Yacht Club now. Yeah, they changed the name. And the Otter Point Boat Club. And those are all cabin cruisers, most of them.
Mm.
And they stream in and out on weekends. Bridge is raised usually once on Saturday and once again on Sunday. Lets them all out. They line up and they go out Saturday and they come back Sunday afternoon.
Hmm.
Of course, there are many of them that can go under that. It's got about a 12-foot clearance without being raised. And there are many outboard boaters in here. The boat club used to have national races. National sanctioned racers. They'd have all the famous high speed boats that race in here. Boy, they would really tear up the river. What were the names of some of those? Turtle was one. They were all the ones that were featured in TV and in the national class racing. The biggest ones.
Mm-hmm.
The river would be muddy for a couple of weeks after they've been through. They throw up rooster tails that go back 50 feet. Tremendous things.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't done that now in about 10 or 15 years. Of course, float planes come in there now too.
So what's that?
Float hydroplane. Dr. Tyson keeps his plane just pulled up on the shore over here, and he takes off, flies off. He's on some sort of medical on call for medical service to boats. And he takes off, flies off. I've seen him take off on the ice without skis though, but with his pontoons.
Mm.
Come back and land on that ice with the pontoons, it makes a terrific racket. I don't know whether it ruins his pontoons or not, but I can't believe they take much of that. Because they break through, and they break through that inch or 2 inch ice, and I would think it would cut them all up.
I see little pieces of driftwood around. Are they from here locally?
Yeah, one over there at the Cedar Stump.
Mm-hmm.
Kids hauled back from on the other side, down on the Aberdeen shore.
Hmm.
It just was a picturesque sort of thing. So mm-hmm. It's been there for 15, 20 years now. Around, anyhow.
Hmm. Well, what made you decide to take all these trips across the country and the world? Is that part of your nature? You enjoy traveling?
Oh, yeah. We like to camp. When we were retired, and that was December of 67, before we retired, months before we retired, we bought a pickup truck and a camper to go on the truck. And we said then we were going to do 100,000 miles of camper travel in the next 10 years. Well, I think we were within 5,000 miles of 100,000 at the end of the 10 years. And we still traveled. We were down Texas last year, down on the Rio Grande, wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
year before that, in the summertime, we didn't take the camper, we just took a tent and tented out to the west coast and back, out in the state of Washington, all the way out in the North Cascades National Park. And we just enjoy camping and traveling. It's hard to break loose from here, though. I mean, you've got to make up your mind you're not going to have a garden that year. And, of course, it's pretty hard to recover from that the next year. But we gave up a garden the year we went to Alaska. We took our camper and went all the way up to Fairbanks, Alaska. So, for a while we went to Florida every winter. We didn't make a thing of going to Florida every winter, but it just came along that time of year, and well, we're going to go to Texas or Florida or somewhere south. And that was before oil got so darn expensive, gasoline. But we have friends that like to camp too.